I like the way you took three different plots, so to speak, and interweave them in the way that you did. And it appeared to me that you also integrated the things you liked the best.
Right.
Yeah, you know, there was a wonderful scene, the bicycle scene. That was wonderful.
That was fun, yeah.
I assume you're a bicyclist.
I am, yeah. I'm sure not of the caliber I put the guy in the book, but I love... You know what's gotten popular out where we live are these mountain bikes. They have real knobby tires, and they have 15 gears instead of 10. And they can go up and down anything. They're like a man-propelled motocross.
And you don't strain yourself going uphill?
Exactly. They're geared so low that you can go almost straight up something. And
not strain yourself?
Well, you know how with 10 speeds they made typical pavement cruising easy, and these brought five more gears below a 10 speed. So you can just, you know, it goes down to where if you're on level you can't even use the lower gears, but on real steep inclines you can get some action out of these. And these tires are overbuilt so they don't pop, and they're a lot of fun. They've become real popular out there. In fact, so popular that the Forest Service has had to cut back on their use because they're digging up terrain.
Well, of course, in addition to the bicycle scene, that was one of the best scenes in the book, I thought. Of course, your hero is also a sailor, and I see there was some in the publicity material. There's a picture of you in your boat. You are at least on a boat.
Right, chartered boat.
Same boat.
Well, it's the boat I envisioned them on, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we sailed around the San Juans to research the area and make sure we had all our facts straight. The book culminates on Salt Spring Island, and that's Salt Spring in the background there. And
Now, where is Salt Spring exactly?
It's just north of what they call the San Juan Islands off of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some lovely islands there that are part of British Columbia. And they're just over the border with Canada, and they're less populated than the San Juans, and real pretty. And I envisioned a rendezvous spot up in there since they would get across the border.
And, of course, the third element that reflects your interest and taste is the fact that Jay is a musician, which, of course, you have been.
Yes, I spent a number of years, now 12 years, on the road as a musician. And felt if I could put an innocent bystander into an espionage plot that I might have an exciting, entertaining book. And so in Blood of the Albatross, I've got a musician caught up in it, and it was fun for me because I was able to share some experiences that I've had out being on the road. Like a young novelist, like a musician, gets the most fun out of their work when the crowd likes it. And in the case of a novelist, when somebody calls up and says they enjoyed the book, it's a real thrill. And at this point in my career, that's the, you know, most reward I get for this. And it makes writing a lot of fun. And likewise, in music, you work very hard for very low pay, and your real reward is the crowd's enthusiasm. And
well, let's hope you get a little more than that with the novels. Now, you set Blood of the Albatross in the Seattle area, but you lived there at one time, I assume.
I lived near there in Idaho, and I have, for the purpose of writing the book, I visited there several times. And I was fortunate enough to get interviews with the FBI and the local police and the head coroner in Seattle and get some specifics that I otherwise wouldn't have been able to get. And in several cases, they helped steer my plot in a more viable direction. It was interesting because I came after the FBI with, you know, could a plot like this take place, since a lot of it's taken out of headlines. And he said, his comment was that anything you can think of has either happened or will have happened by the end of our interview. And that somewhat shocked me. And then there were some technical details. At one point I had a person being discovered on a tapped payphone, and he explained that it's very difficult for the FBI to tap payphones, and went through a complete rundown of why it is. And then I asked him, does this mean you don't tap payphones? And he said, I didn't say that.
Well, so if they knew that a payphone was being used regularly by a subject in an investigation, they would find a way to tap it.
Exactly. They can tap it. Their problem is due to, I guess, some information type rules in the law. If you or I used that phone, at some point they must notify us that we were being taped. even though we weren't part of their investigation.
That's never stopped them before.
No. And that was his point. He belabored why they wouldn't do it, and then he pointed out that they still do it anyway.
Now, you're a young man. You were born here in the East and educated mostly here in the East. How did you find your way across the continent and now live in Idaho?
Well, when I started out in my musical career, we traveled a lot, and I was writing a lot of songs then, and I slowly evolved out of writing short lyrics telling a story in 28 lines, became a little confining, and I began to write screenplays. And along the way, I made some attempts at a Columbo and a Quincy and others. They didn't sell, but they got me in. They moved me in a direction of more dialogue and an expanded format. And I was hired by a person out in the Sun Valley area to help them write a screenplay. And so I went out to Idaho and spent 6 months helping them write a screenplay and absolutely fell in love with the area, and I never moved back. I decided that that was the place for me and wrote a novel and was able to get an agent interested in that novel, and under his guidance I rewrote it many times, and we submitted it to, oh, I think 18 houses eventually, and it was never picked up by any of the houses. So I wrote a second novel, and again my agent, I was fortunate to have an agent who would edit me, and he helped edit me, and I went through six drafts of that novel, and then we began to submit it, and on our seventh submission it was picked up by St. Martin's, and I ended up rewriting it another five times for St. Martin's, and so in all I had written 11 drafts of my second novel, which covered some 6,000 pages through my word processor, and got out the other end with a published first novel.
Why did you stick to this after all of those rejections?
I love it, and I think anyone trying to get started in the writing business has to understand that what you read is not something maybe that came out of the typewriter the first time, that there's a tremendous amount of rewrite and compromise and learning to work with other people in order to get published. And in my case, I was very used to that from writing original music and having bands criticize them and tear them apart and move choruses and put in bridges and whatnot. And I think it was easier for me than some people to adapt to kind of a group effort on a creative process. But had I not been willing to rewrite these books, they certainly wouldn't have been published. And it's a sometimes a frustrating, but in the end it's very rewarding, and now I've got my foot in the door. You know, I'm not Robert Ludlum or Ken Follett in sales, but
not yet.
I've
but you
Albatross
know, they weren't Robert Follett, Robert Ludlum or Ken Follett at the beginning,
well,
either.
That's probably true. And Blood of the Albatross is selling well, and the paperback of Never Look Back is selling real well, and that's exciting. It was fun to walk into an airport and see it on a rack for me.
Oh, I bet that is. And, that's a thrilling experience.
It was for me, yeah. It's, yeah. You know, the hardback of Never Look Back had a limited distribution. It was a first novel. A lot of stores were unwilling to run it. And it turns out that Blood of the Albatross is picked up by, you know, four or five times as many stores now. And but it was real exciting as I got on this promotion tour to walk into an airport out in Seattle, and there was Never Look Back staring at me, and I said, by golly, I've got a paperback out there, you know.
Did you stand there and watch if anybody bought it?
I didn't. I think it would have been a long wait.
One was
missing from the rack, so I was encouraged.
Roy Blunt, who's a humor writer, says he does that. He goes into bookstores and stands there and waits and hopes somebody will buy his book while he's there, but he's reached the conclusion that a watched book never sells.
Never sells. I saw someone, I was in a store here in Manhattan a few days ago, and I walked by and someone picked up my book, picked up Blood of the Albatross from the hardback rack there, and started flipping through it, and I couldn't even look. I left the store. It was like somebody looking at your baby or something. You know?
Well, now Roy would have walked over and said, look, I wrote that book. I'll sign it for you if you buy it.
I should have done that. I have been doing some signings in the area, and I should have jumped on it.
Well, you've written two thrillers, and obviously you're working on some more. Why did you decide that the thriller genre was for you?
It's my heroes in writing, the people I look up to, I have great admiration for John D. MacDonald and his Travis McGee series and all his others. And the early Ludlum books I just love, and Ken Follett I love. And I read so much of this, I wanted to try my hand at writing. It's similar to music in that you end up writing what you like. At the moment in music, my love is classical, and so I'm trying to write orchestral pieces and things like that. But I'm of the opinion that a fun book is an entertaining book, and I think the thrillers are especially captivating and entertaining, and so I've tried to lean toward thriller writing, and St. Martin's appreciates it. They like publishing thrillers. I'm not too much into the high literature. I'm more into the entertaining and exciting, and trying to give a person sort of a movie to read instead of a movie to watch on the tube or whatever.
That's what most people want.
Well, good.
Well, you have not abandoned your musical career, have you?
No, I haven't. It's on a back burner. I play less frequently now, just because in order to keep writing novels, because of the pay scale and the way it all works, I write a lot for trade magazines. I spend my afternoons writing, how to be a better carpenter, or how to be a better bank teller, or how Hewlett-Packard incorporated robotics into an inventory warehouse, or whatever, and that ends up paying my bills, and that is more lucrative at the moment than playing music. And I just, my writing schedule is so busy. I get up at 5 in the morning and work on the novels till about 10:30, and then by just after noon and lunch, I'm back into the magazines, and that takes me till 6 o'clock at night. And on an occasional evening, I will continue into the evening on a different fiction project, and it just doesn't leave you a heck of a lot of time to get a band worked up. But we did manage earlier in the summer to get a repertoire worked up, and we played two or three times in June and July and had a lot of fun. So it's really become more of a sidetrack at the moment and less of a occupation.
Is Idaho a good place to work? I would assume it's, as opposed to Manhattan, where I hear a siren every 7 3/4 minutes.
That.
It must be a nice, quiet place to work.
It's lovely. We're very fortunate to have a nice log cabin out in the woods with a trout stream running by, and I sit in my little room with my word processor and work. And the peace and quiet lends itself to the writing. And I'm near Sun Valley, where there's good resources, a fantastic library. And
that's a resort area.
Yes, it is. It is. And it's
the Hemingways live out there.
Yes, they do.
Jack Hemingway lives near there, doesn't he?
Yeah, he just published a book, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I had him in.
Did you?
Confessions of
a
Trout Fly. Confessions of a Fly Fisherman.
He did a signing at one of the fly shops and the bookstores there. And it's a really wonderfully peaceful place to create. For Never Look Back, we used the library there to get about 80 books to do research. I find that any books that I hit that have misinformation in them, I get angry with. So I try to keep mine as full of accurate information as I can. So in Blood of the Albatross, where they're dealing with the technology, they deal with some subversive types are trying to steal a green laser technology. And I took that out of some trade journals where it turns out we're deploying that in the next couple of years so that we can communicate with our submarines down at the bottom of the ocean, which we can't do at the moment.
What's it like working with a computer and a word processor?
I enjoy it. The first draft of the novel that was never published, I completed it and, of course, had to have it retyped, and it cost me $750 to have it retyped.
Why did you have to have it retyped?
Well, I had to have a submittable draft, and I didn't feel qualified or have the energy to type it myself, and so I hired it to be typed, and it cost so much money that that's when I started looking into word processors.
Oh, this was a typed version.
Yes, the first, right. I didn't have a computer at that point.
You wouldn't have a professional-looking manuscript.
Exactly, a nice-looking manuscript to submit, and a clean manuscript. Of course, the typist put several hundred errors into the manuscript, so I had to clean it up anyway.
On her typewriter, right?
Yes.
On her typewriter?
Right.
Because you can't take it back and make the
corrections
on your own.
Exactly. And so that made me look toward word processors. I realized that the economics of trying to be an unknown novelist and get anything bought, I was going to spend a few thousand dollars before I even had a draft to submit. And I went out and bought an inexpensive computer, and I adapted it to word processing, and worked with that for a couple of years. And I was working with cassette drives and whatnot, so it was unbearably slow. But as the years have gone on here, I've gotten a faster machine with hard disks and all of that.
What do you use?
Now I use a portable compact with a 20 megabyte hard disk on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows me to store several drafts of the book at one time and be able to refer back and forth between them. But it's really the only economical way to attack this business. You can pay for the machine over an amount of time, and it in two drafts of a book, it's paid for itself, because if you had it professionally typed, you'd spend several thousand dollars and on an 800-page manuscript, say.
It takes forever to print it, doesn't it?
It can. I now have a laser printer, and they print incredibly quickly, so it takes about an hour to print a 500-page book.
Those things cost around $6,000. Right?
they're expensive, but, you know, things are
I'd
looking up.
I'd love to have a laser printer myself, but I saw, I think the Apple
there,
laser printer is down to $4,500, but I'm drops to $500. If it does.
Right. I got one that isn't graphics capable.
A Hewlett-Packard?
No, it's called a Cume, and it's as a result, it's about $500 less than all the others. It's in sort of the $1,700 range, which is expensive, but over a three-year period, it's bearable.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, you know, to have a daisy wheel print one of these manuscripts took all day, and you had to babysit the daisy wheel. And this way, I just fire it up, and it prints it out in an hour or so. And
does it... how does it print the paper? You don't have to put the paper in one by one, do you?
No, it's just like a copier.
Mm-hmm.
So you just stack the paper in there, and it grinds it out. Boy, it's fast and clean and beautiful.
Hmm. That's interesting. The printer with your hard disk drive, when you write a novel, do you break it into individual chapters and as separate files, or do you just write one big file with this hard disk?
My third novel, I broke into five. It takes place over 5 days. And so I have five, what I'm calling chapters. Each one, of course, consists of 28 subchapters. But each one of those chapters is stored as its own entity and is maybe 130 pages long.
So you're talking about five files?
Yes, five large files that then consist of subdivided chapters, you know, 5-10-page chapters. That way I can spell check them with a program as a unit and print them as a unit, and it saves me time later on in the actual file management.
Yeah, it sounds like these word processors have done a marvelous thing for writers.
Yeah, I think really the joy of them is the economic angle. They pay for themselves rather quickly when you compare them to having manuscripts typed, and typed manuscripts enter errors that you didn't have in there, so you have to go find them. The computer will never repeat an error. If you find a misspelled word and correct it, every draft from then on, that word will be spelled correctly.
It finds all the misspelled words.
Exactly.
Through it.
And you know, the result is that if you go in and change a paragraph and type up an entire chapter because that paragraph's changed, there will be no mistakes in the rest of the typed chapter. And that's a godsend, because you don't have to check it. You don't have to worry about it. Only that paragraph you typed up do you have to go back in and look at. And that saves an amazing amount of time in the process.
Well, Ridley, you've certainly written a readable thriller with The Blood of the Albatross, and I'm glad you gave me this one. I haven't read this first one, and I'm looking forward to reading that. I certainly enjoyed reading the material, and I was professionally handled, and I'm delighted with it, and I wish you the best. I'll be looking forward to your other stuff. I noticed that you have your guitar. Maybe you'd like to strum a tune or so. You don't have to.
I'd be pleased to.
You know, I thought maybe I might be able just to use a little bit of that as kind of
a
bed
opener,
or production
closer,
element. Or,
sure.
Of course, you write songs, don't you?
Yes, I do. Part of the frustration of my musical years was that all my bands were all original music, and so finding the work was very difficult. and required an exceptional and inordinate amount of queries and going out with press packs and saying, here we are and this is what we do and here's our album and won't you please hire us, and booking tours across the country and whatnot. It's a song I wrote for my wife. Right from the start, your smile was like a constellation, guiding my heart. You gave it without reservation, offered up an invitation to a life so warm and sweet. Is this really happening to me? Right from the start, I loved you like there's no tomorrow. Right from my heart, where there'd been a well of sorrow, always coming, always going, off to some place warm and sweet. Is this really happening to me? Is it really so damn hard to see that you are more than I deserve, more than I could ever hope to dream of? And right from the start, we were from an old-time movie. Both of our hearts, knowing this was how it had to be, knowing it was so much more than anyone we'd loved before, knowing it was oh so right from the start, right from the start. I loved you right from the start. I knew it right from the start, right from the start. I loved you right from the start.
That was very good. And you even remember the words.
Hey, I did.
Can you do another one?
I thought I'd do one that I don't know when your time is, but this is sort of a suburban commuter song, and I thought.
Well, it runs 20 times a week.
Oh, my
morning,
goodness.
Noon, and night.
My goodness. Well, it might fit in there somewhere. Family ways have led his life along. He plays no games and he knows no songs. He deals with facts and is in fact alone. Somehow his feelings never show. He's a slow rider. He's a slow rider, heading home on his midnight train. He's been a long time working in the city of his dreams, making coin to buy his queen. Wife is lost in their suburban town. She plays no bridge and never wears her gowns. She sees a man every other day. He comes to sell and she always pays.
slow rider. He's a slow rider. Heading home on his midnight train. He's been a long time working in the city of his dreams, making coin to buy his queen. How you doing? Who you fooling? Can't you see you always pay? So you cheat now, it's incomplete now, and you go away. He's a slow rider. He's a slow rider. Heading home on his midnight train. He's been a long time working in the city of his dreams, making coin to buy his queen.
That was very nice, Ripley. Very, very nice.
Thank you.
I'm very impressed. You're certainly a young man of many, many talents and interests, and I think that's sensational. Listen, I want to thank you very much for stopping up and chatting with me. I'm going to enjoy putting this together and include some music here.
Okay, I thank you so much.
It's going to be fun to do that.
This is a tremendous exposure. It happens that I'm an absolute fan of your particular station, so it's all the more fun for me.
Oh, well, I'm glad we have a listener now.
Yeah, right.
Thank you very much. Hang on one second.